Welcome to this edition of Back to Basics with Pastor Brian Broderson.
When Jesus tells us to do something, he empowers us to do it. You see, oftentimes we say those kinds of things. Well, I can't. Jesus might be speaking something to us and telling us that this needs to change, or he doesn't want us to do that anymore, or he wants us to make a step in this direction. And oftentimes we kind of come back with that response of, well, I can't do that, Lord.
Today on Back to Basics, Pastor Brian continues his series, Jesus Encounters. Join us as Pastor Brian begins his teaching on John chapter 5, verses 1 through 5, as he examines an encounter between Jesus and the helpless man. Now here's Pastor Brian.
So we continue our series today, Jesus Encounters, and perhaps you remember that in this series we're looking at various people who had these life-changing encounters with Jesus, and we're looking at them as representative of a state of mind, a condition, a situation, something like that. So in other words, we're not just looking at the story as it is, but we're looking at how it would apply to us and how the person that encounters Jesus is representative of many, many people in our world today. Perhaps we ourselves would find ourselves really identifying with that particular person. So today we're looking at a person that I've just referred to them as the helpless person. We're looking at a person who can't help themselves, who doesn't have anyone available to help them. And in this case, a person who, in the end, doesn't even really realize what the root of the problem is and what they really need. So we want to just sort of look at this person and apply that a little more broadly to ourselves or people around us today. So I want to look at three things. I want to look at the scene, first of all, the background, the backdrop to the story. Then we want to look at the person, the man, the helpless man, and then we want to look at the Savior, Jesus, and his response to the situation. So the first thing that I want you to notice is the location of these events. Verse 2 says, "Now there is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porches." Now, Bethesda means the house of mercy. And so there's this pool. Actually, today, if you were to enter into the city of Jerusalem through what's called today the Lion's Gate, and you just go a little ways up the street, and you come to a church there called St. Anne's, and it's in that little compound, a walled-off area, a beautiful garden area, that the ancient pools of Bethesda were discovered. So today, you can actually go and you can see these pools as not as they would have been in their day, because they're ruins now, but you can get somewhat of a picture of what a beautiful spot it was at the time. So it was a very beautiful area, a porch, a colonnaded area with these pools that were probably like mineral baths. And yet in this particular place, it says that there were a great multitude of sick people, blind, lame, and paralyzed, who were there. So even though at one time it was a very beautiful place, at a certain point in time it became this place for the sick to gather, and hoping that they could be healed. That was the belief at the time. And John tells us that there was the belief that an angel had gone down at a certain time into the pool, stirred up the water. Then whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was made well of whatever disease he had. So just to clarify, that was a legend. That was a myth. That probably didn't actually happen, but this is what people thought had happened. And because it was a mineral pool, there were probably types of healings that might have taken place to some degree. There could have even been psychosomatic kinds of healings that resulted. You know, a person just in their mind thought, if I could get in there, it would change my situation, and it might have. But theologically, it doesn't make any sense that there was actually an angel that at a certain time went down and stirred the water, and whoever got in first got the healing. That doesn't fit in any good theological picture of who God is and how he works and what he's like. So I think it's much better to understand this, that John is reporting to us that this was the thinking of the time, and it was the thinking of these particular people that were there. So this is the background, and as you can imagine, it's a hopeless and a depressing situation. So a great multitude, it says, of people who were infirmed. So it's not a place that you would go unless you yourself were infirmed, or maybe you had a friend or a loved one that was there, or you helped transport them back and forth from there. But it's not a place where you would just go, you know, spend time. But yet, we find that Jesus is there. And we find that Jesus is there because what we know about Jesus is wherever there's suffering, wherever there's human need, wherever there's misery, Jesus is there. He's there not just to observe, but as we're going to see, he's there to help. So that's the setting. That's the background. Now, let's look for a moment at the man. So it tells us now about this man, and it says that he had an infirmity 38 years. Think about that, 38 years, a long time to have an infirmity. The man must have been probably in his 50s or maybe 60s at this point. Why do I say that? Because we know from what ultimately transpires in the story that the man's infirmity was directly related to some sinful behavior. And so we know that he wasn't born in this condition. We know that sin brought this condition on. So we can assume that this happened, you know, maybe in what we would call the teenage years, or maybe in his early adult life. But now this sin has left him in this infirm state for 38 years. And he's in this condition, and because of his infirmity, he is incapable of getting himself into this pool. So that's where we see he can't help himself. Not only can he not help himself, but he says in response to Jesus, as Jesus begins to converse with him, Jesus saw him lying there, verse 6, and knew that he had already been in that condition a long time. He said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" The sick man answered, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool." So not only was he incapable of getting himself there, there was nobody that was willing to help him. I have no man. So even though it was considered the house of mercy, it appears that there wasn't a whole lot of mercy being exchanged from person to person. As a matter of fact, what it tells us is, there's no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, but while I am coming, another steps down before me. So it's a kind of every man for himself situation. So there's no one to help this man. We see, again, he's a helpless man. But then we also see that he has a false hope, really. Because as I already said, this was a legend. This wasn't a reality. People weren't healed of this kind of infirmity there. So he's hoping in something that is never going to actually materialize for him. So even if he could get himself into the pool, he would then still be greatly disappointed because healing would not have come. So we see that this man is in a really desperate situation, plus he's just his whole thinking is wrong. So he really is in a hopeless, helpless state. And finally, we see about him that he doesn't even really understand the nature of his problem. He thinks that the nature of his problem is physical. So if he can get in the water, he thinks he's going to be healed. But we know from the conversation Jesus has with him that the nature of his problem is spiritual. So this man, his infirmity was directly linked to his sin. Now, that's not always the case. What we can say is that in an indirect sense, all infirmity, you can trace it back to sin, because before sin entered the world, there was no such thing as sickness or death or any of that. So the existence of sickness, disease, and so forth, there is an indirect relationship to sin. But we would never just automatically say, or should we assume, that because a person is sick, it's directly related to some sin in their life. But there are those exceptions. There are those occasions when that is the case. And that was the case with this man. He was in the condition that he was in because of some sin that he had been involved in. So again, he doesn't realize, though, what his real problem is. He sees it merely as physical. He doesn't make the spiritual connection. So we have the scene, we have the man, and now let's look at the Savior. As I already pointed out, we find Jesus is there. And like I said, this isn't a place where you'd want to go. And if you just visualize in your mind the scene, a great multitude of infirm people, you're not going to want to go there unless you have to. But Jesus goes there because that's what Jesus is about. Jesus is about helping the infirm. Remember, he said himself, he said, those who are whole do not need a physician, but those who are sick. And then he said that he had come as a healer. That was what he had come to do. So he has this conversation with the man, and he asked him this question. As the man explains his dilemma, Jesus says to him, "Do you want to be made well?" Or probably more literally, "Do you want to be made whole?" Do you want to be made well? Now, that seems like a bit of a strange question if you think about it. Of course he wants to be well, right? I mean, that's the whole objective. Get into the pool so I can be made well. But Jesus asked him, "Do you want to be made well?" And, you know, here's something that we don't often realize, but it is actually the case. Not everybody who suffers or is afflicted, and especially when there's a sin connection to it, not everyone wants to be well. We assume many times that, well, of course they want to be well. But in actuality, many times people don't. Because their condition, their affliction, is oftentimes the thing that they use to manipulate, to make people feel guilty, to get some sort of emotional advantage in a situation. We see this kind of thing all the time. I've had many dealings myself with people on the streets, people that live on the streets. I hesitate to call them homeless, even though they are, because when I think of homeless people in the truest sense, I think of, you know, like a family or something that, I mean, they've literally just fallen on hard times and they haven't been able to make their mortgage or their rent or something. They end up living in their car or something. You know, when I think of homeless, I think of that. The person that I'm talking about are people that have chosen to be on the streets. They prefer to be there. Oftentimes they're there as a result of drug addiction, alcohol addiction, you know, things of that nature. And if you've ever had any up close and personal encounters with those people, you find that oftentimes they're very proud of the life they live. They feel very entitled. They see themselves as victims, and they feel like you're responsible to, you know, do something for them. And so it's kind of a lifestyle that they've chosen. I've had many times where, you know, people, you kind of reach out and you know, give them a little bit of money or something. We've had occasions where they said, "Well, that's not enough. Give me more. It's like, well, I didn't know that there was a certain amount you required, you know, but it's this this weird entitlement thing. And then, you know, if you would say to them, hey, there's help for you. I remember years ago talking to a person like I'm describing and telling them about the fact that Jesus could help them and that they didn't have to live like this. And the person actually looked at me and said, you know what? You couldn't live like I do. You're too weak. I'm really like, you know, I mean, he saw himself as some really extraordinary person because he could live on the streets and you know, he could make it on the streets. And so it was a badge of honor. And when I suggested that you could be made well, you didn't want to be made well. So that's my point. Jesus says to him, do you want to be made well? Let's not assume that everybody does. But in this case, of course, this man, he seems to want to be made well. But then, as we've already seen, he begins to tell Jesus about his plight, that he has no man to put him into the pool. And so Jesus says, rise, take up your bed and walk. Rise, take up your bed and walk. You know, this is one of the things about Jesus, and this is one of the wonderful truths that we still need to understand today. The Jesus who spoke these words to this man 2,000 years ago, that Jesus is still living today. He's still working today. And he provides for people today the power to do what he commands them to do. Now, think about it. Rise, take up your bed and walk. The problem with this guy is that he can't rise. That's his problem. He can't do this. But Jesus says, do it. And when Jesus tells us to do something, he empowers us to do it. You see, oftentimes we say those kinds of things. Well, I can't. Jesus might be speaking something to us and telling us that this needs to change, or he doesn't want us to do that anymore, or he wants us to make a step in this direction. And oftentimes we kind of come back with that response of, well, I can't do that, Lord. You know, that's my problem. I can't do it. But listen, know this, when Jesus says to do it, you can do it, because he empowers us to do it. He gives us the ability that we don't naturally have. And just as he did it for this man then, he does it for people today. When you have an encounter with Jesus, the living Jesus, it results in life transformation. It results in immediate work taking place in one's life. So Jesus says to him, rise, take up your bed and walk. And immediately the man was made well. He took up his bed and he walked. And that day was the Sabbath day. So, and again, this is one of the beautiful things that I want to stress about an encounter with the Lord. An encounter with Jesus always results in something beneficial for us immediately. There's an immediate result. Now, the results aren't always identical. Even as we go on in some of the stories, in some cases, the healing of Jesus, there's a little bit of a process that he takes a person through. Maybe you remember reading the story in Mark's gospel where Jesus, he heals a blind man. He spits and he forms some mud and he rubs it in the man's eyes. And then he asks him if he can see. And the man says, I see people like trees walking. And so then the Lord touched him again and brought complete and total sight to him. What that shows us is that when Jesus touches us, instantaneously something begins to happen, but sometimes it happens through a bit of a process rather than everything happening just that very instant. But in this case, it is instantaneous. Jesus says, rise, take up your bed and walk, and boom, the man stands up. Rise, takes up his bed, and he begins to walk. And this is because, as I said, Jesus empowers us to do what he commands us to do. And there's nothing that is beyond his power. There is nothing that is beyond his ability to deal with. There's nothing that he cannot empower us to overcome. There's nothing that he will not deliver us from if we want to be delivered. Yesterday, we were at the beach, as we know now. And throughout the day for the event that we do there, we have a different guys kind of on a schedule, you know, to get up and share for a few minutes with the crowd, the audience that's there. And I was on the schedule twice, and then three or four other guys were on the schedule throughout the day. But in the morning, I got a text from a friend of mine, and he said, "Hey, I'm going to be down at the beach today. My family and I are going to come down." And immediately I thought, okay, if he's coming, I got to open up a space for him to share. So I sent him a text back and said, "Be ready to preach if you come." And so he sent me a thumbs up that he would be. So anyway, he came down, and I gave him one of the slots that I was going to teach in. And the reason I'm telling this story is an illustration of what I'm talking about here. The power of Jesus, when he gives the command, it brings results, it brings transformation. So anyway, as I introduced him to the crowd yesterday, I started by talking about the argument in the culture about, you know, science versus religion and how religion and science are incompatible. And of course, science is right and religion is generally wrong, and religion is unscientific. You know, we hear this all the time. And my contention is that no, actually, if you think about science in the sense of experimentation and empirical evidence and things like that, you can build a strong scientific case for the validity of the Christian message. And the reason I say that is because if scientific evidence is based upon, you know, repeated experiments and things that you can see as a result, well, we can look at millions of people whose lives, we can analyze their lives. We can do an experiment. We can look at millions of people whose lives have been transformed by one thing, putting their faith in Jesus. So to me, that's kind of like a scientific experiment. So anyway, as I was introducing my friend David, I said, so David is, to me, he's living scientific proof that there is a God. And so I asked him, I said, "Hey, in 10 minutes, just give us a quick version of your story." And so he did. And here's his story in a nutshell. And it relates to the story of this man here, because it's a command from the Lord, and then we see the result. So his story is, at the age of 21, he is in prison. He's been in prison several times. He's back in the three strikes, you're out thing. He's in the second strike. And from the time he's 10 years old, he's now 21, he's been addicted to heroin. And so he's in prison. And he tells a story, I've heard this story many times, it's a great story, but he tells the story of a man who's in prison with him who keeps sharing the gospel with him. And he just more or less sort of laughs it off and dismisses it and says, "Man, you sound like my mother, you know, you sound like, you know, other people. I don't believe in God, I don't care, I don't want to hear it." And so the guy says to him, he says, "Okay, I'm never gonna talk to you about this again." And that sort of got him. He's like, "Well, why not?" He said, "Well, you know, I've told you everything you needed to know, and you obviously don't have any interest, so I'm not going to tell you anymore." He said, "But I'm going to ask you one last question.
For the month of February, Back to Basics Radio is offering a book titled Why Grace Changes Everything by Chuck Smith. Grace, it's a word we all love to hear. But do we really know what this word means? Without it, our lives can be dry and dusty. But when grace comes, it transforms our lives into something rich and beautiful. In this deeply relational book, noted Bible teacher Chuck Smith explores 12 great themes of God's unending, beautiful grace. With a passion of a man whose own life has been transformed by this gift, Pastor Chuck clearly explains that we are not bound to God by a huge list of do's and don'ts, and that our mistakes will never alienate us from God, but rather our relationship with God isn't based upon our own efforts, but it's based solely on His unchanging love for us. We encourage you to call us right now at 1-800-733-6443 or visit us online at backtobasicsradio.com to discover Why Grace Changes Everything by Chuck Smith. And when you give a gift to Back to Basics, we'll send you this book as our way to say thank you. We really do appreciate your generous support of this ministry. We'd also like to remind you that all of our other resources are waiting for you at backtobasicsradio.com or by calling our request line at 1-800-733-6443. That's 1-800-733-6443. Our desire is to encourage you in your daily walk with God. We'll continue tomorrow with more valuable insights from Pastor Brian as we continue our series, Jesus Encounters. Back to Basics is the preaching and teaching ministry of Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, California.